everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and I would just love to welcome you today to my show, What Women Must Know. This is the show where you are empowered with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions regarding your health and well-being. And as always, we have wonderful in-depth conversations that really lay out the issues. So we have another great interview in store for you today. Before I get to that, however, I just want to remind everyone we are still in Breast Health Awareness Month, as I like to call it, and have you liked me over on my Facebook page, What Women Must Know? If you haven't, what are you waiting for? I have a whole month of daily posting, sometimes more than one a day, with fantastic information and tips, articles, videos, tests, I mean, just the whole story about breast health strategies. And I just invite you to go up there and take advantage of this information. And also, if you have not yet opted into my website, What Women Must Know, I want to invite you over there as well, because gosh, once you get there, you get several of my free reports about hormones, myths and truths, and the adrenals. You have access to all my articles and videos. My weekly radio shows, which you are listening to right now, are sent to you directly. Even if you're on the Facebook, if you're a fan of mine on Facebook, you'll be getting these shows. So you won't have to risk missing any of the important and wonderful information that my guests share every week on this program. And also, for those of you in the Big Apple territory, so if you're in, you know, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, I've had people come to my program who were all the way down in Washington, D.C. Wherever you are in that metropolitan area, the time is coming where I will be venturing back into New York City. As you know, twice a year I come and lecture at the Natural Gourmet Institute all about hormones, and it will be happening this November, November 17th, that's Saturday, between 2 and 5 p.m., at the Natural Gourmet Institute. It's a fantastic class. You will get absolutely mind-blowing information about your hormones, your health, kind of dispelling all those myths and misinformation that gets us in trouble. So it's a fun class. We get to test things. I bring lots of samples of stuff. You'll have a fabulous time, and it'll be a bit of a revelation as well. So go check it out at the Natural Gourmet Institute. That's 2 to 5 p.m. That's a Saturday afternoon on November 17th. That's the Saturday before Thanksgiving. So I hope to see you there. And let's talk about Breast Health Awareness Month. And to support our growing and essential knowledge base on this subject, we have a fantastic guest today. So first of all, let me share with you a little bit about Dr. Helene Waldman. She has been practicing holistic nutrition in Oakland, California since 2006 and is a graduate of Bauman College of Holistic Nutrition. She received her doctorate from the University of San Francisco in 1994 and has taught at San Francisco State University, Mills College, and currently at Bauman College. She is the author of numerous columns and articles. She has co-authored a book with Dr. Edward Bauman, The Whole Food Guide for Breast Cancer Survivors, which is what we'll be discussing today. And she is also the West Coast board member for the Annie Appleseed Project, a nonprofit organization that promotes education on complementary cancer care, and a consulting nutritionist to Bay Area breast surgeons. And it's going to be a great show. We're going to be discussing lots of important information, whether you are presently dealing with a breast cancer episode, whether you have recovered, left that behind, in remission, moving forward, or whether you just want to get healthy. Everyone needs to have this information. So stay tuned, because it will really help to empower you. And it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Helene Waldman. Hello.
Thanks for that nice introduction.
Well, you deserve it. You're doing great things, and you're in one of my favorite parts of the world, the Bay Area. So it's wonderful. You've made some time. You're obviously a very busy woman, and I really appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation with you. And, you know, your book, The Whole Food Guide for Breast Cancer Survivors, is a fantastic book. I just want to say the subtitle is A Nutritional Approach to Preventing Recurrence. And I think we need to say it's preventing recurrence or just prevention, period. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. That was a decision by the publisher, not by the author. I wanted it to just say risk reduction, but I lost.
You know, there is an advantage to being self-published.
Yes, indeed.
This is a really important topic. You know, it's really dealing with such fundamental issues regarding nutrition and also the knowledge we need to have to move forward in looking after ourselves and getting our bodies healthy again. And yet it's information that seems to often be difficult to come by, or it's difficult to find in one place because it often is conflicting. Do you find that to be true?
Well, I do find that to be true in sort of the popular press. Yes, I find there's, you know, vitamin E is good, vitamin E is bad, calcium's good, calcium's bad. But I think if you get below the level of the popular press and you really get into the literature that, you know, probably you and I look at and study, there's some pretty consistent themes. And so what I tried to do in the book was really gather all of the consistent themes that were really, really well documented out there and just put them in one place and say, look, here's the big picture. Here are the risk factors we're looking at. Here's what we know to be risk factors, and here are specific strategies to mitigate. You know, here's how you assess where you are as far as these risk factors are concerned, and here are strategies to mitigate them. So, yes, I think there's a lot of confusing information, but I think a lot of it is just sort of fluff. You know, you just can't, you can't pay attention to every single thing you read in the paper. It'll make you crazy.
Well, that's true, and it's learning how to negotiate through all this information. And I just want to say, just this week, I think there was an article, a major article published, it might have been in the New York Times, that reported on a study that said antioxidants are beneficial if you are dealing with cancer, going through treatment for cancer, which was a total contradiction to a study that came out, I guess it was maybe a couple of years ago now, that said the exact opposite. So you can see why people go crazy. They listen to the
name. Yeah, people do go crazy, and I think the precautionary principle is used, you know, for good, but sometimes overused. You know, there are a few antioxidants that have been shown to disrupt the mechanisms of a few chemotherapy agents. And that, you know, we've known for a long time. To make a blanket statement that all antioxidants are bad with all chemotherapy treatments is quite a leap, and one that I think is uncalled for.
Right, and often that's what we do. We generalize to everything. Mm-hmm. So we throw out the baby with the bathwater. So Helene, let's look at some of those risk factors to start with, and then we can move into very specific and practical strategies.
Okay. So you want me to just start listing them?
Yes, let's start listing them. And you know, when we can have a discussion where, you know, we can talk about them as well as we go along.
Well, you know, actually in the book, I say, and I truly believe it, I say your number one risk factor is the standard American diet. Hmm. And, you know, I really hate to have to make a statement like that, but when we look at what has happened to our food supply over the years, we see that what we're really eating now, at least if we're eating what I call the standard American diet, or as we know it in the nutrition field, SAD, is food products, but not actually food.
Right.
And the problem with food products, and when I say food products, I mean anything that's not really, that doesn't come from a natural source, that doesn't come out of doesn't come off a tree or out of the ground or from an animal that's been fed its natural diet, is is synthetic, and our bodies don't really know what to do with that. You know, we haven't evolved for enough years that our bodies know, for example, how to deal with genetically modified foods. They're just absolutely foreign bodies. Our bodies haven't adapted to deal with the barrage of pesticides and fungicides and herbicides and the plastics and things. Our bodies don't even really recognize even simple things like meat, for example, that's been fed genetically modified corn and soy, and then sold to us as beef. But in my mind, it's not really beef anymore, because beef is meat that comes from a cow that eats grass, because that's what cows are designed to eat. So all of these things, from those things all the way to all the refined sugars in our diet, again, which our bodies were never, ever meant to deal with, all that refined sugar and all those refined starches and all the refined fats and oils. So when we eat things like chips and French fries, you know, and canola oil and soybean oil and corn oil and all of these oils that are very, 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 very highly refined, again, they're not natural to the human body. So I would start by saying that. Of course, you know, then we have some very, you know, more specific issues, but I would say anything that is not natural to our body is really going to have trouble handling, and that's going to set us up for probably some inflammation and possibly, you know, a nasty immune response to some of these things, and malnutrition. So that's where we start. I can keep going.
I want to stop there for a minute, because we hear all the time that we shouldn't be eating the processed foods and the sugar, but I want you to help my listeners make the direct link to the consequences. What are the consequences? You know, people hear it, but they don't necessarily make changes in their diet.
Let's talk about sugar. After that, I'd love to talk about different fats, because those are also incredibly important. But sugar. Now, let's talk about various aspects of sugar. For one thing, as I said, refined sugar is kind of a foreign substance to the human body. You know, we've eaten sugar that comes as molasses, or that comes even as whole sugar cane and other things, maple syrup, but it's only in the past maybe 200, you know, years or so that we've been eating these vast amounts of refined sugars. Now, sugar actually literally is, or glucose, as we call it once it enters our blood, is the major food source for tumors. They cannot metabolize fatty acids like our other cells can. They are completely dependent on sugar. In fact, Otto Warburg, who won a Nobel Prize, figured this out in around 1930 or so. He called cancerous tumors obligate sugar metabolizers, which means they can only exist in the presence of glucose in the blood. So the more sugar we ingest, the higher that our sugar or glucose level goes in our blood, and that is going to directly help our cancer or tumor to grow. A second effect of sugar is that because our bodies are not supposed to have so much sugar, we have various hormones that help regulate our metabolic processes, and one of them is called insulin. And insulin has many factors. It's a growth hormone. It's an anabolic. We call it a building hormone or a growth hormone. It promotes tissue growth, which in some circumstances can be a very important thing. However, one of its important roles is to regulate the amount of sugar that is in our bloodstream, because if too much of it is circulating in our bloodstream, it'll kill us. So insulin is a hormone, one of whose jobs is to try and manage and suppress excessive amounts of sugar in the bloodstream. So when we eat a lot of sugar, we secrete a lot of insulin to try and suppress all that sugar. Well, insulin being a growth hormone makes everything grow, including cancerous tumors. So I have a lot of data in the book that points to the fact that people who have high fasting glucose levels and high insulin levels have a much higher risk of all cancers and a much higher risk of recurrence of cancers and a much poorer prognosis of existing cancers all the way, you know, from soup to nuts. It's a bad situation to have high glucose and high fasting insulin levels. So that is a major piece of the problem with sugar. And sugar actually also has a depressive effect on the immune system. So they did a study, and this is a while back. I'm thinking I cited it. It's probably from the 80s, something like that, where they gave some teenage boys who have a pretty strong immune system to begin with, but they gave them the equivalent of about, around 20 ounces of a cola. And they found that their white blood cell count was depressed for several hours after they did that. So if you think about somebody consuming several sodas a day, every few hours consuming a soda, that means that pretty much all the time they're suppressed. So we have a few. There's other issues, but I think those are the major ones if people are trying to make connections. I mean, those are some very, very direct implications of sugar and how deleterious it can be.
And I think when we talk about sugar, we have to also include the carbohydrate category, because people need to appreciate the fact that when they are doing a lot of the breads, the pastas, you know, all those great-looking treats at Starbucks, every time you choose one of those luscious little cakes, you're actually doing the equivalent of putting a couple of tablespoons of sugar down your throat.
Yeah, and that's a really, really good point, because, again, until a couple of centuries ago, our carbohydrates were not refined. So when we ate bread or we ate something, it came with the bran part of the seed and the germ as well. But now when we refine those grains, we take away the grain, we take away the germ, and those are the parts that have the nutrients and the fiber, and what's left is called the endosperm, which is the sugar part of the grain. So literally, when we're eating a piece of white bread or a bagel or, you know, a croissant or white rice or anything like that, as soon as that, it's called a refined carbohydrate or a simple carbohydrate, as soon as that combines with the saliva in your mouth, it's sugar. Your body cannot distinguish it from sugar. It is sugar as far as your body is concerned. So indeed, if we are eating a lot of processed foods and we're eating a lot of what we call the whites, the refined carbohydrates, we're not just eating sugar in the form of sugar, but we're eating sugar in that even more insidious form.
Okay, one more thing before we leave the sugar subject. What about artificial sweeteners? Because a lot of people go to the artificial sweeteners, the diet drinks, the diet this, the low-fat that. What's
oh my
the
goodness.
Truth about artificial sweeteners as an option to the sugars?
No, I can give you some other options to refined sugars, but artificial sweeteners are not they. Artificial sweeteners they don't come from, you can see from the word artificial, they don't come from anything that's natural to our planet. So aspartame, for example, is, you know, made in a factory. It's been shown to be a neurotoxin. When it gets heated above a certain temperature, it actually converts to formaldehyde. And so if we happen to be drinking a diet soda with aspartame that's been sitting out in a hot warehouse, then we're actually drinking formaldehyde. Very, very toxic, particularly to the brain. The other thing that the artificial sugars do is they disrupt our satiety signals, believe it or not, in the sense that we're full. So if we drink drinks with these artificial sugars, it really messes with a hormone called leptin, which is one of the things that lets us know that we've had enough to eat. So they actually tend to increase people's appetite and contribute tremendously to obesity. And if you look at another big popular artificial sugar, Splenda. Splenda, they claim that it's natural, but it's actually made with one or two, I can't remember how many molecules of chlorine. Well, chlorine is a known... It disrupts our metabolism in a couple of major ways. One way is that it's disruptive to thyroid function. And the second way is that we all know we put chlorine in our pools and hot tubs and in our water to kill everything in sight. So chlorine kills our healthy gut flora. And as I explain in one of the latter chapters of the book, healthy gut flora is very, very critical for us to have healthy estrogen levels in our body.
And
so, interestingly enough, there is a connection between Splenda and breast cancer. If you could follow that through, we really need those helpful bacteria in our guts in order for our estrogen to be healthy.
What are your preferred healthy sweeteners, so we don't totally depress people into thinking there's nothing left?
Oh well, there's a lot actually. Some people like stevia, which is a plant, and the leaf of the stevia plant is sweet, and some people are good with that. I happen to like xylitol, which starts with an X, X-Y-L-I-T-O-L, which is called an alcohol sugar, and it tastes like sugar and kind of bakes like sugar, but it does not affect a rise in your blood sugar, so it doesn't have that insulin tidal wave that follows it. It also has some antibacterial activity. It's used in toothpastes and chewing gums all the time. So that's something folks could look into. There's also in small amounts, for example, when I bake or I do hot cereal, I use a little bit of grade B maple syrup, which makes things taste incredibly delicious. Blackstrap molasses in moderation is fine as a sweetener. There's also sugar that comes from dates. It's called date sugar. So you don't want to do any of these to excess, but a lot of these are so densely sweet, you only need a little bit in order to sweeten something. And it's worth making sure people understand that fat and protein are the things that help slow down the rush of sugar in our bloodstream. So if we were to have, say, a little maple syrup in the presence of some almond butter or something like that, the effect on our body would be quite a bit less than having that sugar in isolation, because proteins and fats slow down the absorption of sugar into our bodies, and when that absorption's slower, the body's not provoked to secrete as much insulin to deal with it. It's like a faucet. Instead of putting it on full and having it just run like crazy, it's more like the sugar is just drip, drip, drip in a very nice measured way. So there are certainly ways to have sweet things. I have in my book, it's called, I think we call it Helene's chocolate torte recipe. I'm a big chocolate fan myself, and it is an incredibly delicious dessert, and there's no refined sugar in it whatsoever. So as soon as you make this decision that you're going to choose healthy sweeteners, there's a whole universe that opens up to you. There's recipes all over the web. There's recipes in my book. There's recipes in, you know, lots of other books that use healthy sweeteners, not artificial ones.
Let's talk a little bit before we go on a break. We have about 5 minutes before we need to take a break. Can we talk about the fats?
Oh, yes. I love to talk about fat. First thing I love to say about fat is that fat is as critical for our bodies as protein and carbohydrates. And so for people to think that they can be healthy without fat in their diet is kind of like saying, you know, we can live in a house without walls or without a roof or you know, just a critical piece of it. I mean, it's one of the three macronutrients that we need in order to sustain life. So I want to get that out of the way, because somehow our society seems to have convinced us that fat is a terrible thing and that, you know, we should have a fatless diet. Nothing could be further from the truth. The fact of the matter is that we need to choose our fats carefully, because some of them can enhance our health and some of them can very seriously compromise our health. So the fats that help enhance our health, and mainly one of the ways they do this as it relates to cancer, is they help control inflammation, levels of inflammation in our body. So when we eat healthy fats, they actually help to suppress inflammation in our body. And inflammation, like insulin levels, as I mentioned earlier, are an independent risk factor for cancer occurrence, cancer recurrence, and cancer progression. The higher levels of inflammation that are in a body, the more someone is going to, as I say, occur, recur, or progress. So we want to keep those inflammation levels down. Healthy fats help us to do that. Unhealthy fats actually promote inflammation. So by healthy fats, what do I mean? I mean things like olive oil, the monounsaturates, things like olive oil and avocados, macadamia nuts. Certain saturated fats like coconut oil are very anti-inflammatory. And butter or ghee from grass-fed animals is also going to be a very, very healthy source of fat. The ones that we really want to watch out for, and this is difficult for people to come to terms with because they've been promoted as healthy for a lot of years, but the things we find on our supermarket shelves, like corn oil and soybean oil and canola oil and Crisco oil and Wesson oil and all of those supermarket oils, they are very, very, very high in what we call omega-6 fatty acids, which enhance inflammation in our body. Not only that, but they're very, very, very highly processed oils. That's why they can sit on the supermarket shelves for as long as they do. So they're heated to higher temperatures than they were meant to be heated to. They've been bleached. They've been deodorized. They've been extracted from wherever they came from, sometimes with very toxic chemicals. So we really want to stay away from those as much as we possibly can. And we want to use sources of fats that are going, as I say, be anti-inflammatory. So the ones I mentioned, the monounsaturates, the coconut oil, the grass-fed animals, and also the fatty fish. So your salmon, halibut, for vegetarians, walnuts are very high in omega-3 fatty acids. There's a green called purslane, very high in omega-3 fatty acids, which are anti-inflammatory. So we need to choose our fats wisely, and that alone can make the difference between high levels of inflammation in the body and very moderate or low levels of inflammation in the body.
And, you know, I just want to say, and we're about to take a break, so we'll continue with some of these really important strategies that women must know. But, you know, it's just so important to understand that breast cancer doesn't just happen to you. It's not just about bad luck. It's about an imbalance, your body struggling for a long time due to many factors that include the toxicity and the poor nutrition, you know, we're craving specific nutrients to keep the functioning going in our body, and I mean we're overloaded burden of toxins. We need to understand it's critically important to make these changes because it's not just affecting our risk of breast cancer, it's compromising our health and putting us at risk of many chronic illnesses.
Absolutely. You know, they say now that inflammation underlies virtually every major chronic disease, including Alzheimer's. So we really, really need to, you know, watch that inflammation. And unfortunately, the toxicity and the degree of processing in our standard American diet and our environment is we exist, we swim in an inflammatory soup, really, of chemicals.
So when we get back, we're going to be talking to Helene Waldman more about the strategies in her book, The Whole Food Guide for Breast Cancer Survivors, and just overall breast health strategies and some of the things we can do to remove these risk factors and get on a healthy track. So stay tuned. This is Dr. Cheryl Silman. You are listening to What Women Must Know, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You are listening to What Women Must Know. And today we are having a really, really important conversation with Dr. Helene Waldman. She is the co-author of a wonderful book called The Whole Food Guide for Breast Cancer Survivors, A Nutritional Approach to Preventing Recurrence. And as we said earlier in the show, it really should be just to keep ourselves healthy, healthy breast health strategies. So, Helene, let's go back to look at some of the things that in your work and in your counseling with women you consider really critical, risk factors. Let's start there, and then we can move more into the proactive things that you are advising women to do. And we have to say it's also men, too, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. It certainly is true of men, and these strategies are going to be cancer protective for men as well. We simply focused on breast cancer in the book, but these strategies are going to be true for all solid tumors.
Right, right. And, breast cancer is occurring in men, unfortunately. That seems to be a statistic that is increasing, even though it's not huge, but it's still increasing.
Well, it is increasing, and I think, it really has to do with the environmental toxicity. And was it Camp Lejeune, I believe, in North Carolina that just had a small cohort of men who all came down with breast cancer, and they traced it back to a contaminant in the drink, an estrogenic contaminant in the drinking water. So, yes, men are much less likely. They have a lot less breast tissue and a lot less estrogenic activity, but they're certainly not immune.
Yeah. Okay. Well, where do we go from here? What are some of the other risk factors that we really want to make women aware of?
Well, I talked about high glucose and high insulin, and of course that goes with excess body fat. So women who are overweight, and by overweight I mean overweight in terms of excess body fat, not excess body mass. So if you're large boned and you've got lots of muscles, that's more power to you. We're not talking about that. But we're talking about body fat, because the fat cells in our body actually do secrete inflammatory chemicals. And they're also manifestation of high insulin levels in the body. So that is definitely a risk factor that kind of correlates with the glucose, insulin, and inflammation I talked about before. And it's coming to be known as sort of oncometabolic syndrome. Another researcher who I greatly admire named Dr. Jean Wallace coined that phrase, and I think it's very apt, because it resembles metabolic syndrome that people in our society are suffering from, more and more: high blood sugar, high blood lipids, pre-diabetic states, except that this is a constellation of symptoms that really puts one at high risk for all kinds of cancers. So that is there. Now, I haven't spoken yet about nutrient deficiencies. But those are big contributors as well. There are certain nutrients that we know are important for good cellular health. For example, vitamin D. Vitamin D is low in most of the population, and vitamin D is important for good health. And vitamin D is also very important for a process that we call cell differentiation. What we mean is a cell really behaving the way it's supposed to behave. So if it's a breast cell, we want it to behave like a breast cell. And as cells become increasingly de-differentiated, they stop behaving like the organ they're part of, they can become sort of, we could say they go rogue in a way. And they stop listening to instructions from other cells, and they stop hearing messages. And that's what happens as part of the cancer's process. So vitamin D and the whole process of cell differentiation is very, very, very critical. We also have other nutrients that are critical for the function of our immune system, and zinc would be one of those. Zinc is very important to support our T lymphocytes, which are critical cells in our immune system. Also our natural killer cells, which are the cells that would directly be attacking a tumor. So zinc is critical for those. Beta-carotene is very, or the carotenoids in general, are very helpful for good immune function. Selenium. Selenium is critical. In fact, it's called by some to be, you know, our primary anti-cancer nutrient. Part of that might be that it's part of our own antioxidant system in our body, our internal antioxidant called glutathione. We cannot make glutathione without adequate selenium. And glutathione is one of our big protectors against cancer. I say, and that's an antioxidant that we make in our body, but we can't make it without external ingredients like selenium. So selenium would be one I would look at. Magnesium, most of us are deficient in magnesium due to pharmaceutical drugs and stress. And magnesium, the exact relationship with cancer, I don't think is known, but we do know that because magnesium is responsible for over 300 enzymatic reactions in the body, if we don't have enough magnesium, then we're just not firing on all cylinders. So there's going to be a certain amount of stagnation, and there's going to be a certain amount of toxic buildup. In fact, as far back, and it seems ancient now, 1970, there was a researcher who said that hypomagnesia, or too little magnesium in the body, seemed to be an important risk factor for all cancers. Vitamin C is another one. So, you know, there are several. One more that I want to mention before we move on from nutrient deficiencies is iodine, because that is of particular importance to the breasts. Iodine has a lot to do with cellular function, and iodine has a particular affinity for thyroid tissue. It helps to actually make thyroid hormone, and for breast tissue. And what it does is, again, it helps to the cells to differentiate properly. And there was a study that I cited in the book when women had higher levels of iron, the researchers found that tumor cells replicated more slowly, they died more quickly, that growth factors were lowered in the tumor, that the blood vessels that kind of sprout up to help feed the tumor were fewer in number. So I consider iodine to be a very, very critical nutrient for women, and one that is very underappreciated and very deficient in most of us, primarily not because we don't get it, because we do get some, but because we ingest too many other things that compete with it. You know, the chlorine, the fluoride in our water, and the bromide in our baked goods all sit on the iodine receptors in our cells, and they block the absorption of iodine. So of all my clients, I try and test anyone who is willing to do it, I try and test their iodine levels to see where they're at. And everybody, and I include myself in this population, everybody except for one person has shown up deficient in iodine. So that's a real important one that I think is just not talked about, and I want to put it out there.
You know, a couple of years ago, I interviewed a Dr. David Derry. Have you come across Dr. Derry?
I have his book, yeah.
Right. So he's a great guy, Canadian, I believe. And he's a huge promoter of iodine, and he claims that no one in his practice has ever gotten breast cancer as long as their iodine levels are up to optimal range. And you really need to measure it, because you don't want too much iodine either. You need the right amount. So it leads me to the next question. Elaine, what test, do you recommend a test to assess the nutritional status within the cells?
Well, yes and no. There are certain things that we can see from regular blood tests. For example, on a regular blood test, if I look at somebody's alkaline phosphatase level, which is part of a regular blood chemistry panel, I can get a sense of their zinc status. I can get a sense of their protein needs being met by looking at their albumin and their globulin levels. We can do tests for magnesium in blood and other nutrients as well. The iodine test, actually, that I do is a urine test. I'm not aware of an iodine test in blood. I mean, you might know of one, but I don't. So that is a urine test. Vitamin D, of course, we can do in blood, and just by looking at a complete blood count, we can see, you know, things like iron status and things like that. There are specialized tests. There's labs like SpectraCell that do complete nutrient analysis, but I find that I can get a pretty good sense of where my clients are at by looking at a diet journal. I can see if they're ingesting selenium. I can see if they're getting B vitamins. I can see, you know, what they're getting and what they're not, and also by what they're complaining of. So there are some things that I don't feel need to be tested as much as others. Now, iodine is one of those things that is not so obvious, although I can tell you that if somebody, any of your listeners, have fibrocystic breasts, then there's a pretty darn good chance that they are iodine deficient, because that is, that and thyroid difficulties are the, you know, number one and two manifestations of iodine deficiency. So we have various ways of looking at different nutrients, but certainly looking at what somebody is eating and also the quality. I know that if somebody's not eating organic food, for example, that they're probably going to be malnourished, because the soil that those crops are grown in is malnourished soil. It doesn't have selenium in it. It doesn't have chromium in it, which is essential for regulating our blood sugar. It doesn't have trace minerals like boron and vanadium and things, you know, that are going to help our cells function more efficiently. So some things are pretty obvious to me. Some things aren't, and I have to probe deeper.
And, you know, that's a really good point, that we need to find ways to assess whether it's through the means you were talking about as a practitioner, and people need to understand, if they're eating a commercially grown diet, if they're eating a lot of sugar, if they're doing alcohol, you know, bet your bottom dollar you're going to be deficient in most of those nutrients you talked about.
Well, yeah, and the other thing that I do need to mention is that when people are on pharmaceutical drugs, and most Americans are, we know that certain drugs are going to deplete certain nutrients. So women on birth control pills, for example, are going to be low in their B vitamins, they're going to be low in magnesium, they're going to be low in vitamin K. Those are the things that we know are depleted. People who are on certain kinds of blood pressure pills are going to be magnesium deficient. People on statins are going to be CoQ10 deficient, and on and on and on. So we know that certain things are going to push out certain nutrients. So, yes, that is a very big risk factor, because it's these nutrients that help our cells to behave the way they're supposed to. And if we don't have those critical nutrients to give the messages to the cells that if you're a breast cell, you're supposed to behave like a breast cell, you know, if we're missing that, then those messages, as I said, go awry, and our protection is no longer in place.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned the pharmaceutical drugs, and you have a great chart in your book that looks and lists the key pharmaceutical prescription drugs and then the nutrients that are depleted by them, because that's often overlooked. People don't realize that many of the prescription drugs, if not all of them, in some way or other, are depleting key nutrients that are responsible for keeping our immune system strong and our body functioning.
Exactly, exactly. And people also take a lot of, not only do they take a lot of antibiotics, but they also consume a lot of antibiotics. And if they're eating commercial animal products, they're consuming lots and lots of antibiotics, drinking chlorine. Again, they're wiping out those really, really precious gut flora, which make vitamin K for us, which produce certain B vitamins for us, which produce enterodiol and enterolactone, which help to detoxify estrogen for us. They do, as I mentioned earlier, they do all kinds of wonderful things for us.
So we can talk a little bit about the role of probiotics and the best way to get probiotics, because a lot, first of all, we'll talk about probiotics and their role in helping us to keep our body strong and healthy and therefore, you know, prevent our risk, but also the best kinds of sources of probiotics. You know, will the yogurt in our supermarket do the job?
Well, probably not. But probiotics are critical in so many ways to our health. I mean, we really are symbiotic, you know, with the healthy probiotics in our guts. There's trillions and trillions of them, and I'm always hearing from, you know, the experts in this that we have way more probiotics in our gut than we actually have cells in our body. And we want that to be the case. They are a big part of our immune system. So they really, really help with maintaining our cellular immunity. And as I mentioned before, they also are they're just busy little beavers making different vitamins. So they're making vitamin K and they're producing B vitamins, you know, as we speak, you know, in our gut, these things are being made. As far as breast cancer is concerned, they're terribly important because they do, as I just mentioned before, when they mix with nutrients called lignans, and lignans are found in flax seeds and olive oil and some other foods. They're a phytochemical. When the bacteria in our gut actually combine with the lignans, they make these protective compounds called enterolactone and enterodiol, which are anti-cancer compounds. So they are literally helping, they are literally creating anti-cancer, our own anti-cancer arsenal inside of our body. So how do we get these guys? Well, I guess, first of all, one way to try and hold on to them is to try and filter your water so that it's not, you can get the chlorine out of it and avoid antibiotics, because those are going to kill off your healthy gut flora. But in terms of repopulating, fermented foods are a great way of doing this. I just heard somebody say yesterday that when you swallow a probiotic capsule, and I'm not knocking them because they serve a really good function, but you get billions and billions of these organisms. If you eat a tablespoonful of cultured fermented vegetables, you get trillions of probiotics. Mm. And, you know, you look at what our ancestors did and how they kept food fresh and how they were able to keep things for months on end. It was through a process of fermentation. So things like kimchi and sauerkraut and traditionally made yogurt and something I like called beet kvass, cultured vegetables, things like that, they're just brimming with these healthful bacteria. Yogurt can be a very good source, but you have to really read labels scrupulously, because if you look at the label and it says cultured milk and then it says pasteurized, well, pasteurization can heat it somewhere between 200, 350 degrees, so that's going to kill the bacteria. So you want to be sure if you're going to get a yogurt that it says live cultures, you know, added after the pasteurization process. Russian yogurts are known for this. Greek yogurts are pretty good at this. The ones you want to watch out for are your store-bought mass-market brands like Yoplait, for example. I don't think that has any actually live probiotics in it. Other places you can get some is through things like miso, which is a fermented soybean paste. Very good. Like I said, if you want to make your own sauerkraut, it's quite easy to do. You can, you know, if somebody wants to email me, hwaldman@turningthetables.com, or actually in the book we have a recipe for basic sauerkraut. That is a wonderful, wonderful source of probiotics. And not only is it a great source of probiotics, but the cabbage, being a cruciferous vegetable, is a wonderfully healthy food, anti-cancer food. It helps to down-regulate excessive estrogen, and it helps to support our livers in detoxifying carcinogens. So I would say sauerkraut is just almost as good as it gets.
You know, Helene, have you heard of a company called, or a little device called a Perfect Pickler?
No, I haven't.
It's called the Perfect Pickler, and it's perfectpickler.com. And in 4 days, it's a really simple thing. You just do a mason jar, and you put this little lid on it that has kind of like a little distillation-looking tube coming out. And in 4 days, it will turn into fermented vegetables, whatever you put in there. So you can make anything fermented, from pickles to sauerkraut. And I love that little system because it's so easy. You just chop up things, put some water, a little salt, and 4 days later, voila. So
Wow. It's
called Perfect Pickler. So I just thought I'd mention that. You know, before we come to the end, because this show is going really fast, and there's so much great information, and that's the point. There's just so much we need to know that as we make the changes and incorporate these newer preferences, we really are preserving our health and our healing. Can you talk a little bit about the role of the liver and how the liver impacts our estrogen levels and how that becomes another risk factor for estrogen excess and, of course, the risk
factor? Sure. Well, our liver is what detoxifies everything. So if our liver is overloaded, then it's not going to do, you know, as good a job at detoxifying everything, and that includes estrogen. And I think you've read the book, so you know that we have a whole chapter, actually, on both gut and liver health, because we think that healthy digestion, healthy liver function are so important.
Yes.
And one of the things that happens in the liver, as I said, it detoxifies all carcinogens, but for our purposes now, it's very important in detoxifying and helping us to excrete excessive estrogen. And we can help our liver do that by feeding it the things that are going to support its ability to detoxify estrogens. And I mentioned earlier the cabbage, but all of the things that are in that family, so we're talking about cabbage and Brussels sprouts and all the cruciferous vegetables, are particularly wonderful at helping with the detoxification of estrogens in the liver. That's really important because it's not just how much estrogen we have, but it's whether or not that estrogen is going to be protective or proliferative. You know, we have the cholesterol, and they call it good and bad cholesterol. Well, we have the same thing with our estrogens. We have some estrogens, estradiol and what's called E2 estrogens, which are actually protective of our cells, and others that are carcinogenic. And what happens in the liver helps determine whether or not we wind up with the protective estrogen in our bodies or with the, I call them proliferative estrogens in the body. So the crucifers are a great way to support the liver. Lemon and beets are a wonderful way. And anything that's high in sulfur. So that would be things like onions and garlic and leeks. Eggs are high in sulfur. Those are all going to be very good. And then we have a whole lot of herbs that are wonderful for supporting the liver. Of course, the most famous one is milk thistle. But there's other herbs like yellow dock and dandelion and schisandra, orange peel. They've been associated for a long time with vitality and moving things on through the liver. The liver is a very taxed organ. It's got a lot of jobs. So we have to do whatever we can do to help it along.
We need to love our liver.
We need to love our liver. And again, we just goes back to our diet. You know, what we put in our mouths is either going to enhance our ability to clean ourselves, keep our metabolism going, keep ourselves healthy. That's what all the good food is. Or the junk food, the processed food, the bad oils, the sugar, they're going to gunk up the works and get in the way of our cellular and our machinery of our body to do these things. So which do you want? I mean, we have a choice.
Yeah. So, Helene, before we have to bring this wonderful conversation to a conclusion, please
share your website with everyone?
The website for my book is www.wholefoodguideforbreastcancer.com. And then I'll say that one more time, wholefoodguideforbreastcancer.com. And then I also have a website for my practice, because I do work with people, you know, at a distance as well as locally, and that is www.turningthetables.com, and there's two hyphens in there. It's turning-the-tables.com.
Well, thank you so much. This has been such an informative conversation, Helene. I appreciate the wonderful work you're doing, and especially making it really easy for people to understand. I think that's a real gift.
Well, thanks very much for that, and that really was my, I always like to hear that, because that was my objective in the book, was I, there's a lot to say, but if people can't get it, then it's, what's the point? So I really have worked hard at trying to make it accessible.
Well, you did a great job, and I encourage everyone to pick up a copy of The Whole Food Guide for Breast Cancer Survivors by the co-author Dr. Helene Waldman. Helene, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Pleasure was mine, too. Take care.
Bye now. And thank you all for listening today. Remember, if you're in the metropolitan area, please come to my class November 17th, Saturday, at the Natural Gourmet Institute. And until next time, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now. Mm-hmm.